A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rehm, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan on January 5, 1986, entitled, His Light, Our Life. The texts for the sermon are John 1, verses 4 through 5 and 9, and Isaiah 9, verse 2. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
There was a little boy that wanted to know the meaning of the word substitute. And so his father said, well, you remember that basketball game that we went to? And he named the players that started, and then he said, remember how the coach took one out and put another one in? That one he put in is called a substitute. And then he said, and remember when I told you not to play ball and around the garage and you did anyway, and the ball happened to go through the glass and you broke the pane of glass? And he said, yes. He said, remember I had to put cardboard over that window? He said that cardboard was a substitute for the pane. And so the little boy thought he understood. And the next Sunday, he came to church, and there was supposed to be one lady that sang, but another one had to sing in her place. And so he went up to her, and he said to her, you know, he said, you're not a substitute. You're a real pain. Well, thanks, Kathy. Thank you for stepping in and doing such a great job. You really are a window to heaven, right? And God knows we need windows, for the world is full of darkness. The prophet whose voice we've heard in these last weeks, who is no doubt referring to some child that would be born imminently in his own situation, a child that showed promise of being a king and a deliverer, announced that birth by saying, the people who walk in darkness have seen a great light. And they who dwell in the land of the shadow of death, on them has the light dawned. And the church has seen in the birth of Jesus the fulfillment of that prophetic word. For Jesus was also a light born in our darkness, the light of the world. And God knows the world needs light, because it was true in the prophet's day. It was true in the day of Jesus. True in our own day. There's always enough darkness to go around. When Jesus was born, there was darkness. The feast day of the Holy Innocents is celebrated in some parts of the church to remember that children were massacred in order to avoid a child growing up to be a king. The prophet knew the darkness of Israel and Judah's dismal history. And in our own day as well, the world still has enough darkness to go around. The world lives under the shadow of terrorism today, and there's not a great deal we can do about it. Terrorism is the threat of our day. It casts its shadow over everything. And Gaddafi says that if we would strike Libya militarily, that he would teach us what terrorism is in the streets of Middle America. And he would. In the airports at Rome and Vienna, there's massacre, the slaying of innocent victims through the fanatical commitment of Islamic fundamentalists dedicated to their God and to the liberation of the Palestinian people. They live in darkness. They come out of that darkness. They have been fed on darkness, and they create darkness in the world. Saudi Arabia says to us, don't retaliate militarily because it will only escalate the violence. And it will. And so, we don't really know what to do. We admire Israel, who has shown such finesse in being able to retaliate. And yet the retaliation doesn't end the matter. It raises it to another level. There was a Jew one day who said, they who take this sword will die by the sword. His name was Jesus. But the world still tries to fight fire with fire and consequently creates the continuing shadow of darkness. I think it was on the evening news last night. The most recent graduates of some PLO splinter group that think that Arafat is soft, graduating from a terrorist school in the mountains of Syria, ready to give their bodies and their lives, their whole destiny to the cause, ready to bring terror anywhere in the world, and we can flex our muscle, rattle our missiles. But what can we really do? There's darkness enough to go around. We live in a world that lies in darkness, and it's always been the case. And I suppose that if I invited you to come forward this morning, you could also, out of your own heart and life, share with me some tales of darkness. Well, you didn't come to church to hear about tales of darkness, but let's acknowledge at least that there is darkness in our own hearts. There are denials and betrayals and disappointments and frustrations and deaths. There are griefs and anxieties and fears, and some of us have a very cloudy path before us, so that there's always enough darkness to go around, God knows. And it is the message of the gospel that light has come to dissipate our darkness. That Jesus is the light of the world, and into the darkness of the world has shined a light that keeps on shining. And so we stand on the 12th day of Christmas. Tonight is Twelfth Night Eve. In some traditions and cultures, presents are shared tonight. Tomorrow is the day of Epiphany, and we enter a new season. And that word means manifestation. And the motif of Epiphany is light, and the sign is a star. And the Christmas story is followed close on by Epiphany, because the Christmas miracle and mystery of the Word becoming flesh brought light into the world. The light that shines in the darkness, that dissipates the darkness. And so we celebrate Christmas and we move into Epiphany and we follow the star and we rejoice in Jesus, who has come, the light of the world, to enlighten our lives and show us the way. For in the darkness, one cannot find one's way. The darkness is foreboding, full of threat and peril. I remember years ago traveling in California, and having a destination in Yosemite National Park in a lodge, and not knowing the territory and not knowing the roads and not really knowing the distance or the time it would take. Dallying too long along the road, night fell. and we were not yet there. And I remember the twists and the turns of that unfamiliar way. And I remember coming into a period of time when it seemed as though the blackness could be cut, the darkness could be felt. I have never been in such a tangible darkness in my life. And when you don't know where you're going, and you don't know whether you're going to get there, and signs are few, and nothing is familiar, and everything is alien, the world becomes full of fear. Finally, there was a little light, and then another, and then, sure enough, the lodge. And in the darkness, went into the lodge, into the room, retired, not knowing where we were, knowing nothing about the environment or the setting, but having felt the darkness. With the drape still pulled in the room, stepping out in the morning into the most dazzling sunlight. And rising behind the lodge, the sheer cliff of rock, towering toward the heavens. And from its apex came cascading down this magnificent waterfall, hundreds of feet. Sky was blue, the setting was magnificent, it was God's world, and all creation was singing His glory. I've never known such a transformation from the foreboding sense of darkness that was tangible into the wonder and the splendor of sunlight and the glory of creation. Imagine that that's what the gospel writer had in mind when he said that a light has dawned on the darkness of the world. The transformation of the landscape, of the environment, and of the human spirit, everything was different. All of the fear and all of the anxiety, the ghosts were gone. All was brightness and joy. Jesus is the light of the world. And John, in a more reflective way than Matthew or Luke, Matthew and Luke will never be supplanted. They tell the story. I mean, who would ever do away with the story of angels and shepherds and the chorus of the heavens and the star and the sky and the magi? Those things will be with us forever. But John, in a more reflective way, tells his story of Christmas in an equally beautiful and moving and magnificent fashion. He tells us that the miracle of Christmas was the incarnation of the Word that was the very life and heart and will of God coming into human form. In this prologue to his gospel, John portrays for us the miracle and the mystery of Christmas in a reflective way that speaks to the whole of reality and tells us that this is our Father's world that has flowed out of the depths of his being from eternity past. That what God was doing in the beginning in creation, he completed and consummated in his coming to full expression in the face of Jesus. So this is our Father's world, and in Jesus he is calling it back to himself, and we are his people who live and rejoice in the creation which is his, following the Son who is his, the light of the world, Jesus Christ our Lord. This is our Father's world. In the opening statement of this prologue, John says, "In the beginning was the Word," and he calls to our mind immediately Genesis 1:1, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." But here he says that the framework for the incarnation of the Word must be as broad as the cosmic sweep of God's activity. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God, and apart from him was not anything made that was made. The agent of creation was the Word, and the Word in the Greek language means logos, and from logos we get our word logic, or reason, or word. The Word was with God. The idea was in God's mind. The thought was in his heart. The intention of his will was manifested in the actual creation of the heavens and the earth. And he says in the beginning, the writer tells us that in the beginning God had this intention to create, and that creation itself, all of reality, has flowed out of the intentionality of God to share himself, to give himself, in a most amazing statement. John tells us, all that came to be was alive with his life. Think of that for a moment. All that came to be was alive with his life. We narrow down our faith so terribly. We think about our faith and our religion in a little compartment. But if we get the impact of the gospel, then our faith in Jesus Christ, in God the Father, is as broad as the cosmos itself. For what the writer of this gospel, who is pointing to Jesus Christ ultimately, is telling us in the very beginning of his gospel is that everything that is because Christ enlivens it. All that came to be was alive with his life. The life of God flowing into the life of the Son becomes the life of the world. And our life is lived in his light. All that came to be was alive with his life. And that life was the light of men. The whole reality is permeated with God's presence. All of reality holds together because God holds it together. A couple of weeks ago, I mentioned the public television presentation, The Creation of the Universe, in which the physicists and the astrophysicists and the nuclear physicists and those that deal with atomic particles were sharing how science is moving and is to the threshold of discovering that one unifying principle or formula that will explain the secret of the structure of all of reality. And I cannot begin to comprehend the intricacies of that mental gymnastics that they took us through in that film, although it was marvelously done. But I am sure of this, that the finest minds who have been researching from Einstein on, looking for the secret of the structure of reality, when they find it, will find it spelled G-O-D, that at the heart and center of the universe is the eternal God who called all things into being. And what our writer is telling us here is that all of reality is alive with his life. So that Jesus is not something apart from the world. And we are not some strange pilgrim people apart from the whole of creation. But we are a people who have learned the secret that the whole of reality has flowed out of the intention of God. That he has created, that he sustains, that he has revealed himself who is the creator and the sustainer of the heavens and the earth. Our salvation is as broad as the world and the galaxies and the stars and outer space. And the God that we worship is the God who holds the secret of the formula of the structure of reality. The writers of the New Testament always made that connection. The writer to the Hebrews begins by saying, God, who in various times spoke to our fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by a Son, who he made heir of all things, by whom he created the universe. And the Apostle Paul, in his letter to the Colossians, speaks about how the whole fullness of the Godhead dwelt in Jesus bodily. But in another place he says that in Jesus, who was the firstborn of the whole creation, through whom all things exist, of this Jesus, he says, in him all things cohere or hold together. Now, I don't know if Paul understood any physics. I don't think he did. But they were also, in those days, sophisticated, learned, philosophical. And the witness they were bearing, without having the equipment to probe into the structure of reality such as we do, is that very same thing, that all of reality holds together or has its unity in Jesus. Why don't atoms go skipping off all over the place? Why do the planets stay in orbit? Why is there something rather than nothing? The Scriptures witness to the eternal God who had an intention to create, who called all reality into being, and who continued that revelation of Himself, that flowing out of Himself in the incarnation of the Word, so that that which was at the very heart of reality, that which was at the very heart of God, that called the worlds into being, finally came to expression in a human being. The miracle of Christmas is that in a human person, we see into the very depths of God's heart and mind and intention. And Jesus was not an afterthought. Jesus was not an emergency measure. Jesus was simply the culmination of that flow out of the depths, the eternal depths of God, which manifested itself in the galaxies and the cosmic sweep, and in the fullness of time took up residence in the human nature of Jesus. Paul put them together beautifully when he said, the God who caused light to shine out of darkness, the God of creation, has shined into our hearts the light of the revelation of His glory in the face of Jesus. And so we look at Jesus, the Word made flesh, and we see into the depths of God, the God who created it all, who holds it all together, whose world this is, whose revelation in the face of Jesus makes Him accessible and approachable to us. This is our Father's world. And we're a part and parcel of a cosmic sweep of an eternal God of grandeur and glory. Friday, that was the day, wasn't it? That day of better than 2 months of gloom when the sun shone brightly. I remember a day like that about 5 years ago. One comes about every 5 years here. But I remember getting on my cross-country skis and going all by myself out through the dune, and I came into a clearing of pine trees where never a foot had trod, where the snow was undamaged, untrampled, with the sun streaming into that clearing, the sky beautifully blue, the green pines, and the quiet. Now, what could you do but worship at a moment like that? This is our Father's world. I hope you'll always come here to hear His Word proclaimed, but I hope you will not think that somehow or other there's a corner here on the proclamation of the Word, for the Word is proclaimed in the whole cosmic sweep. A sunset, a starry night, a wintry day when sun glistens off the pure ermine of the snow. The same God who said, let there be, reveal Himself in a human person in the face of Jesus. All that came to be was alive with His life, God's life, God's energy, permeating it all. This is our Father's world. And in the very midst of this world, there was a human being, Jesus. And in Him, we see the mystery unlocked of the heart of God, who upholds all things and calls us to Himself. Jesus, the Word made flesh. And at the beginning of this year, 1986, we enter into uncharted ways. And there's darkness enough, God knows. There are questions unanswered, perils unforeseen. We live one day at a time, and we really know not where our pathway will take us. But this light that was the life of men, the fifth verse tells us, this light shines on in the darkness. And the darkness has never, what? Well, it all depends. John loved mystery. There are a number of words in his gospel that can be translated one way or the other. And the commentators are divided. It's possible to translate it, the light shines on in the darkness, and the darkness has not comprehended it or understood it. Perfectly legitimate translation, and it's true too. Jesus was hanging on the cross, and he cried out, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. You look at those young men committing themselves to their leader, fanatical commitment to die if need be and spread terror throughout the world, thinking that somehow or other liberty and freedom and human well-being can come through terror and violence and murder and death. I have to say, they don't understand. We don't understand. The light shines. The problem is not God's. The light has been shining. The light has been shining in the face of Jesus. His way is clear. The pathway to which he calls us is obvious and open. Love is stronger than hate, and only love finally can triumph in the end. Now, the problem is not that there is no light. It is that we love darkness rather than light. And so it could be translated, the light shines on, and they just don't understand. But you can also translate it, overcome. The light shines on in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it or conquered it. That's wonderfully true too. For there's darkness enough in the world, God knows. But the light shines on. And the darkness has never, nor will the darkness ever again be able to envelop the light. The light shines on in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. And so in our lives too, the darkness may be there, but there will always be the light to dissipate it. The darkness may come in waves upon us, but there's always the light shining to sustain us, strengthen us, and keep us. All that came to be was alive with his life. And that life was the light of men, and the light shines on in the darkness, and the darkness has not comprehended it, overcome it, conquered it, will never be able to snuff it out. I have a little Bible that I often use in calling, and if you took and opened that Bible, you would find some greasy finger marks at certain places. One of the greasy finger marks where a thumb has rested many, many times is at the page in which there is Psalm 27. Because there was a lady one day who was entering into her own darkness, afraid, alone, wondering what surgery would bring, until she took hold of Psalm 27 and kept saying over and over to herself, the Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? And the light brought peace. The peace to go through the valley of the shadow and to conquer the darkness. And of course, the lady was my mother. And because that was her psalm, it has become my psalm as well. But it is the light, you see. The light that keeps the darkness at bay and enables us to go on knowing that because He is our light, we have nothing to fear. Come what may, whatever assault of darkness there may be, we are more than conquerors through Him who loved us. For He is the light of the world, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness will never overcome it. Thanks be to God.